This is the word of the living God. Verse 1 of John chapter 6. After this, Jesus went away to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, which is the Sea of Tiberias. And a large crowd was following him because they saw the signs that he was doing on the sick. And Jesus went up on the mountain, and there he sat down with his disciples. Now the Passover, the feast of the Jews, was at hand. Lifting up his eyes then, and seeing that a large crowd was coming toward him, Jesus said to Philip, "Where are we to buy bread so that these people may eat?" And he said this to test him, for he himself knew what he would do. And Philip answered him, 200 denarii worth of bread would not be enough for each of them to get a little. And one of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said to him, "There's a boy here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 fish. But what are they for so many?" And Jesus said, "Have the people sit down." Now there was much grass in the place, so the men sat down, about 5,000 in number. Jesus then took the loaves, and when he had given thanks, he distributed them to those who were seated, and so also the fish, as much as they wanted. And when they had eaten their fill, he told his disciples, "Gather up the leftover fragments, that nothing may be lost." So they gathered them up and filled 12 baskets with fragments from the 5 barley loaves left by those who had eaten. And when the people saw the sign that he had done, they said, "This is indeed the prophet who is to come into the world." Perceiving then that they were about to come and take him by force to make him king, Jesus withdrew again to the mountain by himself. That's the first sign. Let's read the second. And when evening came, his disciples went down to the sea, got into a boat, and started across the sea to Capernaum. And it was now dark, and Jesus had not yet come to them. The sea became rough because a strong wind was blowing. And when they had rowed about 3 or 4 miles, they saw Jesus walking on the sea and coming near the boat, and they were frightened. But he said to them, "It is I, do not be afraid." And then they were glad to take him into the boat, and immediately the boat was at the land to which they were going. Thus ends the reading of the Word of God this morning. Now, there's a lot going on in that story, but I want to give you a little bit of an insight there into kind of what's in the background of this, the narrative here of Scripture in John chapter 6. For the nation of Israel, right, God's people, the Jews, there is no greater hero than Moses. He's it, right? He was their greatest religious leader. And God used Moses to deliver them up out of Egypt. God used them to lead them through their time in the wilderness. He governed over the people, and he brought them to the outskirts of the promised land, even though he did not take them in there himself. Now, many consider maybe someone in their nation's history usually as one of those people they look up to and see, you know, in our nation, right, we have George Washington, perhaps, right, the founding fathers, and we think of things like that in other countries, great political leaders, great religious leaders, and people esteem them and revere them. But the reverence that the Jews had for Moses, right, far exceeds all of that, right? It would pale in comparison to how the religious Jews felt about Moses. So in what Jesus is doing in these two signs here, the commentary that's going on there, that's in the background, the people's devotion and esteem and reverence for their religious leader, Moses. Now, when we last looked at John's gospel there back in June, some 9 or 10 weeks ago there, we see in the end of chapter 5, Jesus rebuking the religious leaders. And he rebukes them and tells them this. He said to them, "The one who's going to accuse you is that one that you look up to, which is Moses." Like, he's going to stand in accusation to, because Moses wrote about me. The one Moses talked about, the one Moses promised was coming, was about me. So if you didn't believe Moses, then you're not believing me. So he's rebuking them in that aspect there. And that's how chapter 5 closes there, and John opens chapter 6 there after this. Well, it was after that particular event right there. Now, as we've looked at this before, John's gospel is a little bit different. It's not chronological, right? Luke, very methodically tries to present a timeline of events, right, of the life of Jesus from his birth to his resurrection. John has a different slant in his gospel, right? And John 20:31 is really the purpose statement. So it's good for us to kind of revisit it since we've been kind of away from this gospel for so many weeks there. And John says, these things are written for what purpose? That you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name, right? So everything John does is to serve that purpose. It's to serve that end, that people would trust in Jesus Christ, that they would trust that he is exactly who he claimed to be. So what we see in this meticulously detailed account here has a purpose, to reveal that Jesus is the Christ. He's the Messiah. He is the promised one. And John calls the miracles that Jesus does signs, right? We don't see that in any of the other gospel accounts, but John uses that word for a particular purpose because these miracles communicate something very important. I've said it before that signs are messages wrapped in a miracle, right? The miracle just serves as the wrapping, but there is a message that John wants people to see clearly about who Jesus is. Lauda, God rest her, she was resting on Friday night, but she was so kind to make these bacon-wrapped jalapeno poppers for Citigroup. And she sent Eric on his way to our house to bring those there, right? And I think those poppers are a perfect illustration, man. They're wrapped in bacon, right? And we love bacon, don't we, right? And you look at that, and that bacon's amazing. But it was only superseded by how delicious those jalapeno poppers were on the inside, right? And these signs, right, we tend to focus on the miraculous. We focus on the divine intervention, this divine move that Jesus, you know, heaven touching earth here in this moment, the kingdom of heaven being manifest, right? But there's this important message that's trying to come through and thunder through that sign. And John is hoping people grasp that so that they would believe. So today we're going to look at these two back-to-back signs, okay? And we're going to see that God sent them someone greater than Moses, someone better than Moses. So we're going to walk through these three things. The first thing I want us to do is to look at how John connects Jesus to Moses, because he's drawing this parallel between Jesus and Moses so that people can see it. And they understood it, and we'll see that in this particular passage here. The second thing is we're going to look at how these two signs, what do they reveal about Jesus? And lastly, what do these two signs reveal about us, our faith and our hope in Jesus Christ? So let's look at Jesus' connection to Moses, all right? Because this is what John is doing here, paralleling two accounts, two events in the history of Israel that they would have been very familiar with now and showing how these signs link Jesus to Moses there. And so I'm just going to run through these quickly and you can just make note of them there. And while you're at it, too, we're going to continue with what we started during our summer series by answering questions at the end of the service as they relate to the theme and today's message. So if you have anything like that, you can text it to the number in your sermon handout, 321-280-9000, and we'll take a few of those at the end of the service if there are any. So here's how he connects Jesus to Moses. First, the thing we see is Jesus is leading a large crowd. We see Jesus now ministering to his disciples, and as customary, a large crowd begins to gather, and now Jesus begins to teach them. And then we see that just like Moses, right? He led a large nation, a large group of people. The crowd is following Jesus because of the signs he was doing. It's obvious in this passage. You'll see it again with Jesus mentioning this at the tail end there of chapter 6. They're following Jesus because of the miraculous, right? All these things that are happening. Well, the people followed Moses because of the signs he was doing. The signs he was doing, the plagues, right? This is the reason they trusted that God was delivering them and using Moses to do that. Those signs authenticated his role as one sent by God. We see Jesus going up to the mountain to teach his disciples and the crowd that gathers. In the Old Testament, we see Moses going up with Joshua to the mountain to receive the law from God. John mentions here that these events take place during the Passover. It was the time of the Passover. And that feast is very important and is a central figure in John's gospel here. Well, the Passover, right, is the celebration, the annual feast and celebration of God's delivering his people from out of bondage in Egypt, right? The 10th plague, which was the murder of the firstborn, and how the people of Israel were delivered and rescued from that through the slaying of the Passover lamb, which typified Christ. Okay, and then they were passed over, and the firstborn wasn't killed. Well, we have that as a parallel in the story. And then these two signs, parallel events, that are found in the Exodus story here. How the people of God were miraculously fed in the wilderness through the manna from heaven, and how they were delivered and rescued from out of Egypt in the crossing of the Red Sea. So let's look at those two historical events there from the history of God's people in Exodus there, right? Moses leads his people through the wilderness, right? And this is the story, just to quickly sum it up. There, many of you know this, right? He was leading them towards the new home that God had promised them, right? Took them out of Egypt, and God says, there's a place for you. There's a home I'm preparing for you. Now, that journey took a lot longer than was anticipated, but it was right on time according to God's plan. All right, so you imagine leading 1.5 to 2 million people. Think about that. Traveling slowly through the wilderness, right? Trekking all of these people, men, women, and children, and animals, and everything else that they had with them through the wilderness. I'd imagine at some point, and it probably happened rather quickly, the obvious problem arose, right? How do you feed 1.5 to 2 million people? You're moving. You're traveling through the desert. There's no time to stop and plant crops and wait for something to come forth, the produce from the land. They certainly didn't have enough wherewithal to pack 40 years worth of food in their saddlebags, right, when they left Egypt to take with them on this journey. That's an impossibility. So what do? People begin to grumble. They're hungry, right? Most of us don't even last a few hours. Imagine, you know, leaving all of that, the adrenaline of Pharaoh's army behind you, and you're trying to escape and go forward, and then, yeah, it's going to hit you, right? Your stomach starts grumbling, and they start complaining. So how are they going to get fed? Well, we know that God provides the solution, right? God himself would provide the food in the form of this tasty bread-like thing called manna that would show up every morning on the ground. They didn't have to bake it. They didn't have to go buy it. God miraculously sends this from heaven each and every morning. They wake up, they open the door of their tent, and there it is on the ground. Nobody knows what it tastes like. Nobody knows what it is. I envision it being something like the little honey bread there at Texas Roadhouse with some butter slathered on it. I don't know. That's one of the tastiest things I know that's out there, right? This had to be something amazing. God provides it. And he does this for them every single day until the day they enter the promised land. And they could come out with their basket each day and just pick up enough for their family just for that day. They couldn't hoard it. They couldn't store it up in their pantry, because if they did, it would rot overnight. Every day, God was going to provide it. And every day, it was a test to see whether they would depend on God, whether they would rely on God and trust in God every single day. So Jesus now faces a similar situation. A large crowd has gathered. 5,000 men plus women and children. Could have been upwards of 10,000 people on that mountainside, listening to Jesus, hungering and hanging on every word, looking at, you know, obviously also looking and pursuing the signs, right? Because it says he was healing the sick that were among them. And they wouldn't leave. They weren't going to go away. And if you read the parallel accounts, this story is found in all four Gospels, Matthew 14, Mark 6, and Luke 9. You're going to see the feeding of the 5,000 in each one of the gospel stories, and each one kind of gives you another little nuance to this particular story that kind of fills in the gaps. But in those other parallel accounts, we see that the disciples actually wanted Jesus to send the people away. They knew it was getting late. Their stomach was grumbling. They were wondering where they were going to go eat that night. And all these people, they weren't leaving. They wanted Jesus to send them off. And Jesus sent them off to the town for lodging and for dinner, right? The hour is late. But that's not what Jesus does. Jesus turns to them and says, you feed them. I got a better idea. You guys take care of it, right? And he turns to one of his disciples, Philip. And we see it in the story here. And he asks Philip, hey, Philip, where's the closest Walmart? Where's the closest place we can buy bread for all these people? That's a crazy question when you think about 5,000 plus people. Now, you've seen any of our supermarkets kind of during hurricane season. There's nothing there, right? They make a run on the shelves. Could you imagine food for that many people? How's that going to happen? And the story tells us there, Jesus already knew what he was going to do, and he did this to what? Test. To test Philip. And Philip fails the test, right? He fails the test. He's like, man, not even 8 months' salary could be enough to give these people just a taste, a little bite, right? We can't even buy a 4-pack of nuggets from McDonald's for these people. I'm sorry, Chick-fil-A. We're Christians in here, right? Chick-fil-A nuggets, right? Can't even buy those. Not even one. We don't have enough. It's just not enough. So Jesus sends them to inquire to see what's out there. And Andrew comes back and says, well, Jesus, I have a little boy here, 5 barley loaves, which is one of the cheapest breads. Like, that was like the poor people's bread. 5 barley loaves and 2 little fish, 2 little mullets. I mean, worthless little fish. That's all I found. And what does he say? But that's not going to do any good. Like, what is that? With all these people, I mean, we have nothing, right? And we know the rest of the story, right? He takes that little meal. He gives thanks. He blesses it. And he tells the disciples to distribute it. And miraculously, this is multiplied over and over again. Every time they put their hand in the basket, bread and fish. And not just a bite. Not just a little sample of it. It says they ate till they were satisfied, till they had their fill. And there was so much of an abundance, right, that 12 baskets of fragments were left over. And at Jesus' command, he said, make sure you pick everything up so that nothing is lost. Now, kind of remember that little detail, because we're going to talk about that next week in some of the things Jesus says at the conclusion of this chapter, right? An amazing, amazing miracle that parallels God's provision for his people in the wilderness, how God fed the multitudes there. And Jesus feeds the multitudes here. Just as God provided through Moses' leadership with man in the wilderness, God provided through Jesus on the mountainside. So that's the first parallel that that John uses here to connect Jesus to Moses. The second is found in the other sign that we just read there as well. In order for Moses to lead the people of Israel out of Jesus, they faced an immediate obstacle. Really, 2 of them. Behind them was the army of Pharaoh. In front of them was a natural barrier, the Red Sea. And they find themselves there at the edge of the Red Sea with Pharaoh's army breathing down their back. They've got nowhere to go. They are trapped. They're trapped. And we know the story here, right? God commands Moses, stretch out your staff. He stretches out his staff. God sends a mighty wind, right, that begins to part the water, right, and divide it and spread it so that this 1.5 to 2 million people could cross the Red Sea on dry ground. I mean, I can't even fathom something like that. I can't even imagine that, right? There's no Hollywood movie that could do something like that justice to see that with your own 2 eyes there. They cross through on dry ground. When Pharaoh's army comes in behind them, what happens? Right? They're drowned, right? They're obliterated there. And God gloriously rescues his people through that. So then here we have this account here of Jesus now sending his disciples off. He tells them, cross over to Capernaum. Just get in the boat, go across there. And I imagine they're waiting for him. Like, aren't you coming too? How are you going to get across? Like, why are you sending us over there and you're staying over here? But it says then that Jesus went up to the mountainside. The other accounts tell us he went up to the mountain to pray, to go to a desolate place to pray, to seek his Father, to commune with his Father, and to talk with his Father. So he goes up to do that. It says the hour is late, and it got later. It's finally getting dark, and the disciples decide to go ahead, in obedience to Jesus' instructions, to go ahead and cross over. And what happens through the night there? They're about going across, and it's a 7-mile journey across the sea there from the place they were at to Capernaum. About halfway through, we're told there that strong winds start to happen. A storm begins to brew in the midst of the sea there, and things become increasingly difficult for them. Have you ever been boating in rough seas? That's no fun. right? But if you're in a powerboat, you kind of can push through that right there. Could you imagine rowing in that? I mean, that's crazy. And it's pitch black. And this storm, man, this tempest brews up there. Wind and water, thunder and lightning. We don't know the intensity of it, but it was severe to the point where it says they were rowing, and basically they weren't getting anywhere. Matthew's account says they were beaten by the waves. Mark says making headway painfully, right? Rowing and getting nowhere. They're exhausted. I mean, they're fighting this thing because if they stop, they may capsize, right, and be lost, right? But somewhere around 3 to 6 in the morning, the other accounts call it the fourth watch, somewhere around the fourth watch, as they're rowing and they're exhausted and they're miserable and they're tired, they see something, right? And they're terrified. The other accounts tell you they thought they saw a ghost. And I think you'd see a ghost too. I think you'd call it something like that, especially when we find out what it was, right? Because we know it wasn't another boat. It wasn't another person rowing up alongside them to see if they needed help. We find Jesus kind of strolling across the sea as if he was on dry ground. The other account says he was just kind of passed right by them. I mean, that's just insane. That's like a comedy. I mean, put yourself in that moment, man. What was Jesus doing there? And what would they be thinking? I mean, you'd be terrified, I think, too. And if you've ever been in a storm out at sea at night, and I have been many, many, many years ago, you do start seeing things. You just do. Especially if it's lightning and the shadows and waves, and you start seeing things, right? And their eyes, they can't even comprehend what they're seeing. Jesus walking on dry, like he was on dry ground. And Jesus notices how terrified they are. And what does he say? It is I. Do not be afraid. They bring him in. The other account tells us about Peter and his deal of jumping out there with Jesus. We're not going to get into that today. But it says that immediately the storm ceased. And instantly their boat was at land. Isn't that crazy? That's some serious transportation Jesus does there, man. In a moment, in a blink, once he is invited into the boat, he steps in and the storm ceases and they are on dry land. So think about those two signs. Those miracles parallel these two events that the people would have been familiar with, right? Moses is their hero. Moses is their great hero, man. That's who they revere. That's who they esteem because of how God used them to deliver the people. Everybody knows Moses. Even today in secular Israel, there still is a reverence for the historical Moses, okay? So he was a big deal. So here comes Jesus now doing his stuff, these signs, and these two miracles here that happen to coincide and connect to these two great events for God's people. So what do these things reveal about Jesus? Well, with these two signs, Jesus is identifying himself as one like Moses. He feeds the people like Moses. He crosses the sea like Moses, right? And both in ways that require, like, divine assistance. They can't happen in the natural. These are natural impossibilities. And yet Jesus is able to perform these miracles. So the first thing, what do these two signs reveal about Jesus is this, that Jesus, once again, and we've seen this over and over again in John's gospel, Jesus has all authority and power. All of it. He is supreme. He is divine. He is God. He is who he has claimed to be. The obvious thing we see from this signs, again, is this continuing revelation that Jesus has supreme authority. The feeding of the multitude demonstrates what? That Jesus has authority over the material universe, the material world. Like if he can manipulate food and multiply it, right, with a word, he's got power. He has authority, right, in a domain that no human has. Turns five slices of Wonder Bread and two little fish to feed a multitude. His walking on water and silencing the storm demonstrates his authority and power over nature and the physical world. Who can do that? Who can do that with a word? Silence a hurricane. So he has supreme authority and power. And here are the disciples, witnesses, right, to his deity on both of these occasions. They get to peer into this divine nature of the Son of God in his glorious incarnation. Jesus has supreme authority and power. The second thing we see about what it reveals about Jesus is that Jesus is God's promised deliverer. And we see in this story here that the people get it. Like, if finally, I think, clicks for the people who've been following Jesus, observing the signs, are witnesses now, and they can partake of this amazing public display of power and authority, they get it. They say in verse 14, because they interpret the sign correctly, this is indeed the prophet who is to come into the world. Notice it doesn't say a prophet. It's the prophet. And the prophet is the one that they had been waiting for centuries. Right? So we need to turn to this promise God makes his people so you can see that. Deuteronomy 18, 15 through 19. You're going to see it on screen here. Okay? This is Moses talking to the people, giving them instruction. He says this, "The Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from among you, from your brothers. It is to him you shall listen. Just as you desired of the Lord your God at Horeb in the day of the assembly, when you said, 'Let me not hear again the voice of the Lord my God, or see this great fire anymore, lest I die.' And the Lord said to me, 'They are right in what they have spoken. I will raise up for them a prophet like you from among their brothers, and I will put my words in his mouth, and he shall speak to them all that I command him. And whoever will not listen to my words that he shall speak in my name, I myself will require it of him.'" Right? This is the promise. God is going to send the prophet, someone like Moses, someone God is going to raise up from among them. Okay? And this is Jesus. This is whom God has sent, right? Jesus was making it clear that he was the prophet like Moses. This is the prophet. This is the one the people had been waiting for. The close of Deuteronomy, we find there something very, very beautiful that's said about Moses, right? Because this is actually what the people thought about him. Verses 10 through 12 of Deuteronomy 34, the last three verses there, says this in regards to Moses: "There has not arisen a prophet since in Israel like Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face. None like him for all the signs and the wonders that the Lord sent him to do in the land of Egypt, to Pharaoh, to all his servants, and to all his land, and for all the mighty power and all the great deeds of terror that Moses did in the sight of Israel." Right? So not a prophet has arisen like Moses, right, until now. Until Jesus shows up, right? So the wait's over, right? They see the work of Jesus, they see his authority, they see his power, and they immediately make the connection and recognize this is the fulfillment of that promise in Deuteronomy. This is it. This is it. Now they get it. Someone like Moses shows up, right? What do you think they'd expect of him? They would expect someone like Moses to do what Moses did, which was what? Deliver them from their slavery. And what was their slavery at this time? Rome. Yeah, Rome, right? This is their oppressors, right? Someone like Moses show up, they're like, it's time for revolution. Right? The revolution has begun, you know, fists in the air, who knows, right? They're seeing there. They're seeing now an opportunity. They're saying, this is him then. This is the one God has promised. It's time, right? It's time to throw off our oppressors. It's time to throw off our captives, right? And this is the person to do it. They want to go to war against Rome, and they want to force Jesus into kingship. He's the one who's going to lead us towards that. Like, so that was their agenda. That's what they wanted. That's what they desired. And Jesus wasn't going to have any of that, right? It says he perceived, right? He perceived their wrong motives, and he disappears, right? He moves away, man. He sends his disciples off, and he's like, I'm going up the mountain to pray, to get away from the people. And we see this happen a number of times in the gospel accounts. See, Jesus' intentions were not victory over Rome. Jesus' intention was victory over sin, death, and hell. That's what was before him. That was the ultimate triumph, the greater victory. Moses won a great victory, but it's nothing in comparison to the victory Jesus won when he rose triumphantly. That's why Jesus is the better Moses. He's going to lead God's people out of spiritual bondage, captivity, into freedom and life in God's kingdom, right? He's going to deliver them from their sins. And these two accounts there, these two signs continue to build the case that John is presenting here, that he is the one, right? That's who you believe in. That's who you place your trust in. And when you believe in him, you will have life in his name. Jesus is the better Moses. Right? We sang that song here at the end, Jesus is better. Like, do you believe that? Do you believe that, right? John is making the case here that he is better. He's superior to Moses in every way. He's the one God has promised. But what do these two things reveal about us? Because there's always secondary and tertiary applications we can draw from these passages. Now, they're there for a purpose so that we would believe. They're there so that we would trust in the supremacy of Jesus over all things, his authority and his divine power, right? And I pray you get that. I pray you really receive that and believe that, and you can stake your life upon that. But what do these things reveal about us? What do they reveal about our faith, right? Because I think if we can look at the response of the disciples in this passage, we see a little bit of ourselves in there. We see maybe a shadow of how we respond in the midst of circumstances and situations in life, right? It wasn't the first time these guys were eyewitnesses to Jesus' power, right? We've already studied a few of the signs. The first was when Jesus turned water into wine. I mean, just a miraculous thing takes place before them. They were there, right, when he just with a word heals the nobleman's son, right? They were there when he raised the paralytic off of his mat. They were there to witness all of these healings and miracles, all of those things there. Powerful stuff happening. And both of these stories reveal to us that Jesus then is looking for something from his followers, and what he's looking for is faith. He's looking for faith. He's looking for his disciples to have faith in him. Like Philip, man, this should have been a no-brainer for Philip. Philip, where do we get bread? I don't know, Jesus, but man, you did the stuff. I'm guessing you're going to do it here again too. It's going to be awesome. Andrew, what are we going to do? We just got this. It's not enough. No, man, Andrew's response should have been, here it is, Jesus. I know it's not much, but I know you're going to do something awesome with it. It's looking for faith. So first thing I want us to look at, what does it reveal about us? It's how we respond in the midst of impossibility in the situations and circumstances we have in life. Impossibility of our situation. Because we catch a glimpse here that this miracle of the feeding of the 5,000 wasn't just for the 5,000, right? It was for the disciples too. It was just as much for the disciples. Because they continually underestimated Jesus' authority and power. The problem that presented itself in that moment, a large crowd who's hungry and tired, is no match for the divine Son of God. And these disciples, above anyone else, right, should have gotten that. They should have seen that. Again, Philip was being tested by Jesus. We're tested by Jesus too. We're continually tested in the trials and situations and circumstances of life to see whether or not our reliance and trust is upon the divine power of Jesus or in our own human solutions to our problems. Philip's answer again reveals that he fails the test. He fails the test. Philip chose to focus on the immensity and impossibility of the problem that was before them. Massive crowd, no food, no place to get bread, not even 8 months' wages is going to even provide a little morsel of food from Jesus. We can't do it. Send him home. Send him away. Send him to the village, man. Send him somewhere down there. Send him to Denny's. But we cannot handle these problems. And I know that's just like us, isn't it? I know it's just like me. when we're confronted with problems that are too big for us to solve, seemingly impossible obstacles, usually we default to, this is too much. This is too impossible. It can't possibly happen. Can't do it. Like Philip, we realize we're powerless, helpless to bring about a resolution. I mean, we try to. We fixate it on it. We focus attention and energy to fix a situation in our life, but it is beyond us. And like Philip, because I'm like this too, we can spit out all of the statistics and all of the facts, look at all the practical reasons of why this is too big of a problem to tackle. Why it's too big of a problem to overcome. And it doesn't matter what it is in life. Because Philip here, he's the pragmatist, right? And there's one in every family, isn't there? He wants to bring everyone back down to reality, right? The dream crusher, right? We had that. Well, I was an administrator in a church I was on staff at. Well, we'd come with all these great ideas, man, to do big things. And he'd say, get a little calculator out, you know? Yeah, we don't have money to do that, you know? Now, here's Philip going, oh, we don't have enough money to do that. It's too impossible. It's too big, Jesus, right? See, it's not about faith for us. It's about facts. Always looking for human solutions to a problem that requires divine intervention. And just like Philip, we forget who's right there with us. Underestimating the power of Jesus, the one who's all-powerful when we are all powerless, right? Standing right next to him. And we say, Jesus, it's too impossible. It's too much. Can't do it. Philip's response, man, should have been, all things are possible with you. There's nothing impossible with you. We've seen it. We're eyewitnesses to it. We know you can do it. I don't know how you're going to do it, but I know you do. And when we're faced with impossible situations in our life, when we're faced with something crushing and overwhelming in our life, what do we default to? Is it looking at the facts? Is it instead of gazing with eyes of faith to the one who can do the impossible, like that this is nothing for him? Or do we just focus right on what's before us in our humanness and how we ourselves could bring a solution to this? And when we can, we just throw our hands up. It's too impossible. It's too hard. It's too difficult. It's never going to happen. The second response of Andrew here is one that on the surface there looks like it has some promise to it. Like, all right, Jesus, we found someone with some food. But then the next statement, right, betrays any faith we thought he might have. But what good is it going to do? And I know, because I've said that many times. I look at my resources. I look at the scarcity that is before me, and I go, it's all we got. What good is it going to do? Forgetting, right, the miracle of provision here from our great God and Savior Jesus Christ, who fed a multitude, right? Andrew says, it's not enough. He couldn't see past the little that he had to solve the problem. Now, we know in the natural, he's right. He's right. Was that enough? No, it wasn't. Some of you come from large families and have a lot of siblings, right? When dinner time comes, right, and the bread's put out the table, right, it's like a war, right? Because it's probably not enough, right, for seconds or thirds or whatever you want to eat, right? And there's arm wrestling and there's fighting going on, especially for that last piece, right? The last bite, right? It's not enough. In the natural, it's never going to be enough. But like Andrew, you and I grossly underestimate our wealth. See, Andrew, all he thought he had was what? His five little barley loaves, his two little measly fish. The disciples looked at the immensity of the problem, the scarcity of their resources, and determined, not going to happen. Not going to happen. And we sit here and think, because sometimes we're really hard on the disciples, and then we just look, man, they're just a reflection of us. Because I sit here and I read these stories and I go, like, what's it going to take for them to stop doubting Jesus, man? Come on. They've seen all these, they're eyewitness. We're just reading about these miracles, man. They were, poof, they saw them. They were there, man. They watch the withered hand come out. They watch Lazarus come forth from the tomb. Like, they saw this stuff happening. They saw the miracle of people putting their hands in a basket and pulling out as much as they want. Like, what does it take for them to stop doubting? But we could say that about ourselves, right? What's it going to take for us to stop doubting? Because we suffer from the same thing that ailed them. They had a deficient view of Christ. And often that is the root of our deficient faith. We don't really believe that he can do the impossible. We don't really believe that he can provide for us, that he cares for us, that he knows our needs. He looks at our situation and we think, it's probably not going to happen. It's impossible. These two signs reveal who Jesus is and how we respond in the face of our difficult circumstances and situations. Again, do we see with the eyes of faith that Jesus can do the impossible? Or do we gaze at the facts and calculate the situation, look at it from our human perspective and determine it's impossible? So what's Christ showing them through this? Because this was for them, right? This was for them. In the feeding of the 5,000, right? Jesus is saying, man, that tiny little thing in your hands, that's more than enough. Do you trust me? Do you trust I can provide? Do you trust I can feed this multitude? Do you trust I can feed you? When Jesus supplies, it's never too little. It's never too little. We have the great promise of Ephesians 3:20, right? To him who is able to do far more abundantly than you and I can ask or think, according to the power at work in us, right? He's the God of the miraculous. He's the God of the impossible. This is not just a cerebral faith, guys. This is not an intellectual pursuit. Like, there's times when the stuff just doesn't add up and we go, but God. There's just time when we don't have enough. The situation looks grim, but God, right? Wait, that's where we should be. This is where you and I should land. Is our faith in him? Or is our faith in the facts? Jesus has never run into a problem that's too big for him to solve. Do you believe that? There's no solution that he has where the resources will ever run dry and there's nothing impossible for him. Nothing at all. Now, how he answers, how he chooses to answer, that's in his purview. It's for his glory and for our good. I don't care what the outcome looks like. What I know is I can trust, right, that he can do the impossible. That he can see me through a situation, right? That he can provide, even if it's in the 11th hour, right? And it's usually like that. There's a reason there's delays. Because there's a testing of our faith. Every day that manna would show up on the ground. And I'm sure every night they were wondering, is it going to be there tomorrow? I know I would be. Right? I wonder if God's going to do that tomorrow. Oh, we should have kept some. But we can't keep some because worms start coming out of them, right? It starts to rot and stink in the cupboard. But every day, God was faithful. God was faithful to supply for them. And lastly, I'll breeze through this one. That second sign, right? Storms. The storm the disciples find themselves in, right? Jesus walking on the water starts with what? The disciples in trouble. But here's the fascinating thing. The disciples weren't finding themselves in trouble because they were disobedient to Jesus. They were exactly in trouble because they were obedient to Jesus. They were obedient to Jesus. And just like the disciples, our following Jesus guarantees that you and I will face some fierce storms in life. It's guaranteed. You're wanting to follow Jesus, you want to obey Jesus, there's going to be storms. You're going to hit them head on. The winds are going to be contrary to you. And when we're in the midst of the storms, like, it seems dark. John uses that word dark to not just typify physical darkness, but also spiritual darkness. It's the same word in the Greek. And he's saying here, it was dark, man. It darks. We don't feel like we're making headway. waves crashing all around us. And I know in the midst of that, the disciples are just like us. We're just like them. Because they're wondering, why isn't Jesus in this boat with us? Like, he sent us off, and now look where we are. We're about to lose our lives. Where is he? Where is he? I know for myself that I've found myself in situations and in trials and in heartaches in life and those kind of things and affliction where you wonder, it's dark, the storm's here, I'm trying to obey Jesus. Where is he? Where is he? Where is he in the midst of all of these things? Where is he when we're in the thick of this stuff? And here the disciples are rowing helplessly, man. They're going nowhere. They're going nowhere. They're trying, man. That wind's coming against them. It's hitting them head on there. But there's something interesting in the parallel accounts. Because it says that when they were in the midst of that storm, Jesus was still on land. And they're 3.5-4 miles out in sea. And it says that Jesus saw them. He saw them. He saw them struggling. He saw them rowing helplessly. He saw them in their miserable condition. He saw the wind and the waves slapping up against them. He saw them. And yet he delayed in coming to rescue them. Why is that? Why is that? I don't know the answer to that. But in thinking through that, I think sometimes, you know, in looking at our own situations in my life, the point I come to when I just come to surrender, right? And because I'm at the end of myself. I can't anymore. I tried in my humanity to fix and solve and resolve and all these things, and I'm at the end of my rope. And I call unto the Lord. And I think that's where the disciples were at this point, just at the end of themselves, man. They were miserable. They were exhausted. They couldn't do this anymore. They're trying, and they probably thought this was over. Where was Jesus? He came to them during the fourth watch of the night, the darkest time. That's when Jesus shows up walking on the water. Like, they were terrified. They were afraid. We would be too. But those words of Jesus are so profound, right? It is I. Do not be afraid. No, he doesn't reverse that. He doesn't say, don't be afraid, it is I. Or it's like, recognize, right? It is I, right? Why would you be afraid? Like, I'm with you. I'm with you. There he is. And instantly their attitude changes because they heard the voice of Christ. Following Christ is going to bring us into storms, right? That's part of life. It's part of life. It's inescapable. I know it, I wish it weren't so, but it's that way. There are trials. There are tribulations. There are persecution. There are sufferings. Like, that's guaranteed. Our attitude should be, bring it on. Because Jesus is saying, it is I. Do not be afraid. Do not be afraid. But here's what we need to know in the midst of that. He sees us. That is one of the most comforting things I read in this study. He sees us. Like, when we're going through it, it's not like he's removed. It's not like he's turned away from us. It feels that way to us when we look at things in the natural, but it's not the reality. He sees us, and he cares about us. And that's beautiful. And John wants us to believe that. More importantly, Jesus wants us to believe that about his care for us. So Jesus has the ultimate authority and power. We're going to see this over and over and over again, and we need to continually be reminded Jesus is better. Jesus is superior. He is the ultimate. It's true. When the situation looks impossible, when the resources look scarce, when the storms of life and darkness surround us, you and I can trust in Jesus. We can believe, man. He's a specialist in those impossible situations. Man, that we would be a people of faith like that. Yeah, we do the things in our humanity. We do the things in the natural. We do what we're supposed to do. But we come to the end of ourselves. When we come to the end of ourselves, God is right there to meet us. Jesus is there, and he sees us, and he'll help us through that. So I want you to take comfort in that, saint. Believe in who Jesus is, right? This is what we're called to do, and that's keep on believing. We don't believe one time and are saved. Right? We keep on believing, right? That's the verb tense in John 20, 31, that by believing, continuing to believe. Why? Because our believing grows. Our believing increases, right? To believe in what? Not ourselves. Believe in Christ, that Jesus is the Son of God, and that by believing, you and I have life in his name. Would you go ahead and stand?